Hi, so my name is John Heidemann. I'm a researcher at University of Southern California, based physically in Marina Del Rey, just down the street here. So we have a research lab in the two twin towers, the white buildings you probably drive by. So I do full-time research there, and then I teach once a year at USC. And also, so you were talking about you're a USC alum. So I actually graduated from UCLA, so we got all the bases covered here tonight. And I want to talk to you about network reliability, some research we've been doing in this area. This is research with a bunch of people. Joe Bannister is actually at Aerospace Corporation now. Christos Papadopoulos is at Colorado State. Jen and Lynn are graduate students who have graduated, both of them, since then. And you're a staff person with me. And this work is supported by the Department of Homeland Security. Yuri Pradkin, he's a staff person with me at Information Science Institute. So one theme you're going to hear in this talk is how do we take ideas all the way to impact, because lots of people do research. There's plenty of professors in the world, but I at least, and many people, want to have their work have impact in the real world, and that's one reason I'm here tonight. But that's another theme that comes through in our research, and I want to talk about how that works. And so to go from an idea, a wild and crazy idea, to impact in the middle has to be research to prove the idea, and then there has to be tech transfer to make sure the idea works out and can be used over the long term. And the two sides to that question are really science. Is this idea true? Does it work? And engineering, can we make it practical and use it on a day-to-day basis? And in our case, those questions are things like, can we measure the internet? What can we measure about the internet? And the practical impact is, what can we tell about the internet's reliability? Now, in between those, there's this problem, which is, the technical term is valley of death, which is that getting stuff from the first paper all the way to the technology that other people outside of the lab can use is perilous. There's lots of ways it can go wrong, and so I want to share with you some of the work that it took to get our work to that point. And I'm going to talk to this using two examples. So one example, the first example that got our work kicked off is scanning the internet. How can we scan the internet to answer a very simple question? How big is the internet? How many computers are there on the internet? So, you know, lots of people make estimates, but getting a hard number for that is tricky. And then the second question that I'm going to take you on, or the second journey that I'm going to take you on, is one of, we noticed this funny thing in our data. There were these gaps. How do we, what was going on? How could we debug that? And that led us to this work in network outage detection. So I'll talk about that as well. So the people, so there's Yuri. There's a picture of Yuri. And myself and my graduate student. The graduate student is actually back in Beijing now. He's a Chinese national. And I'm very happy that he graduated. There's the rest of the team at the bottom. And we have colleagues that I'll tell you about. In fact, I'm very lucky. I have support from not just Colorado State, but also KU University in Japan and a university in Athens to support some of our measurement infrastructure. And we're working with the FCC, and I'll tell you about how that works out. And as I said, this work is supported by the Department of Homeland Security, the Science and Technology Directorate.
What is the name of your unit?
I am part of Information Sciences Institute. That's the building on the top. At USC, and my particular lab is called the Ant Lab, Analysis of Network Traffic. That's the, hence the little ant in the up corner. Okay? So going back to these two journeys, let's start with the first journey and talk about this. So lots of people have drawn pictures of the internet over the years, and here you can see some of the ones that if you go look at a textbook, you'll see some of these pictures in it. So the top left picture is the first picture of the internet. John Postel, we think, drew that at UCLA when there were four computers on the internet. The picture on the bottom is a measurement that Ramesh Govindan, one of my colleagues at USC, took in 1999. And that's one ISP, so you can see it. That's just one ISP. It got a lot more complicated. One internet service provider, so one cable and wire, this large British telecommunications provider. The map in the top center is supposedly the complete internet, although to make it be a pretty picture, they actually got the whole graph, or they got as much of the graph as they could, and then they deleted most of the links. Because if you plotted all of the links, it would just be one big blob of color. But it makes a nice picture and a nice story. And then the bottom right is another visualization of the internet. But the thing that all of these have in common is the very first one, Postel's figure in 69 there, measured all the internet computers. There were them. Okay? And the last time this was done, David Smallberg, also at UCLA, did this in 1994. At that time, there were about 370 or 80 of them or something like that. But if you notice, the internet's a little bit bigger now. And so when people started drawing these maps at the bottom, they gave up on counting all the hosts, and they started just trying to map the network core. What are the routers and things that make the mesh of the network? And there's technical techniques that have been studied to do that for a long time. Traceroute is one. Maybe some of you have done Traceroute, where it tells you the path through the internet using probing messages, diagnostic messages. And other people have measured routing. That's another technique you can use. It turns out routing information, the routers will talk to you if you ask nicely, and they will give you their view of how the internet's wired together at a very coarse level. And the neat thing about these techniques that are being used today is they scale to the size of the internet. So we can do trace routes for the whole internet. We can take routing tables for the whole internet. Routing tables have about 400,000 entries in it. And trace routes, I don't know, they get millions of entries. But anyway, but the key thing is they've given up on actually counting all the computers in the internet. They're just measuring the links and stuff. So our goal, my group's goal starting in 2006 or 2004 or so, was can we fix this? Can we actually count all the edge hosts on the IPv4 internet? And can we do this in a way that scales to the size of the internet today? Not 400 hosts, not four hosts, but millions of hosts. And our approach is pretty simple. We use a program called Ping, which you may have also run. If you run Traceroute, you've probably run Ping. Anybody can do it. It contacts the host and says, you know, are you there? And, or you can choose not to reply. It's up to you. And if you might be firewalled or there's all kinds of things, but Ping is widely used and it pretty much works for the most part. And so we do a couple of different things. We do what we call as a census. So in a census, we ping every single IPv4 address. And then we do what we call surveys, where we pick a few addresses and we ping them frequently for 2 weeks. And then the research part of this effort is to quantify the sources of error. So we don't want to just take pings and say, oh, that's what it is. We want to take pings and we want to know roughly how accurate is this result. Okay? So that's what we do.
Can you explain ping for
not everybody? Sure. I have a picture that will come up just shortly. But roughly, ping is a program. In fact, the program you run is called Ping. The technical term is ICMP. Echo response is the message I send out. But basically it sends a packet, a message, to an IP address, and I'll talk about those in just a minute as well, and it says, are you there? Echo response, right? Will you echo a response back to me? And then the computer that you probe says an echo reply. That sends a message back to me. And usually the echo reply says, yes, I'm here. You can also say, you know, there's a bunch of error codes. It can say, prohibit, can't do this. Or the most common response, if they don't want to reply, is they just don't. Does that make sense? So it's like knocking on somebody's door and saying, are you home? Or it's like walking to every driveway in the house and looking up and seeing if there's a house there and then going and knocking on the door and seeing if somebody replies. Okay. So the impact of this is to try to answer this very simple technical question, how big is the internet? How many computers are on the internet? Okay, so this is my pig slide, so I'll say a little bit more. Right, so internet addresses you probably have seen if you've ever set up a home Wi-Fi router or your cable modem or something. So they look like 1.2.3.4 or 192.0.2.1. So they're four numbers separated by periods. And what we do when we ping the network is we send these ICMP echo requests or pings. And so we send out a ping and it goes out to the computer and then the computer sends back an acknowledgement. So that's, we plot that as a green dot typically. Okay. Now there's a bunch of other possible responses. So if there's no computer there, probably what happens is we get no response. And we plot that as a black dot or a black square. Okay. Now other things can happen as well. So if your laptop is, somebody's laptop is, no, everybody's, well, if your laptop is powered off or suspended or something, we'll probably also get a non-response. Even though there's a computer there, we're not going to wake it up typically. Or we could ping it, and if you have a firewall set up, you might say, no, I'm not going to respond. And then the case that we really care about that we'll get to at the end, later in the talk, is if the network's broken, we'll ping it. And then what we get also is probably a no response. Okay. So one thing you might notice is we have positive acknowledgments. That'll help us catch, count how many computers there are. But we've got a bunch of other things that all look the same. And so the challenge here is how we disambiguate these. And we'll talk about that, too. Okay, so does that make sense for ping? Okay.
How about the milliseconds?
Well, we're not looking at the milliseconds yet. But we may see those later. So the neat thing that we observe is, you know, there's only 2 to the 32 addresses, right? 2 to the 32 is about 4 billion IPv4 addresses. And you know, computers are pretty fast. You can count to 4 billion in a couple of seconds. So it turns out we can probe the whole internet. We can probe 4 billion addresses, or actually it's only about 3 billion for a variety of reasons. And we can probe pretty fast. So when we started, we had 4 computers probing away, and it took us about 3 months. We've gotten a little faster since then. We probe with 1 computer now in about 2 months, and we're not going as fast as we can. You can go a lot faster than that. And when I get to outage detection, we'll talk about how we probe much faster than this, in fact. Anyway, so we're going to probe all the IP addresses. And when I say I'm counting computers on the internet, I'm actually counting IP addresses that are active. So if you have a cable modem, and maybe you have a computer and a laptop and a tablet and stuff. I mean, only one of those is publicly visible. Only your cable modem is publicly visible. So I'll count that as one computer. So I'm actually technically counting the public unicast IPv4 internet, if you want to get technical about it. But so I'm like counting houses. The other term that will be important later in the talk is I talk about blocks of internet addresses. And so internet addresses go from, you know, 1.2.3.4 or from 0.0.0.0 to 255.255.255.255. So when I say a block of IP addresses, I mean we're going to keep the first 3 parts fixed and then we're going to look at all the last part, right? So we're going to look at 0.0.0.0 to 0.0.0.255, all the 256 addresses. Okay, so 256 adjacent addresses. Okay, and we look at, we actually probe 4 million blocks for our outage detection every 11 minutes, so we're probing very quickly. And then the challenge in this work is how do we interpret the results? And then the other challenge, maybe not as obvious at first, is how do we do this politely? Because when you do anything on the internet to 3 billion addresses, people notice. Most people don't notice. You know, there will be one or two that notice, and let's just say the university president has gotten an email from one disgruntled person in the past. You know, so people can make a stink. And so I'm going to say a little bit in this talk about how to interpret these results scientifically to give results that we have confidence in. And then I'm going to talk more about how we probe politely as well. But I promised to say a little bit more about IPv4 addressing. And in particular, I'm going to talk about how I draw pictures of the internet. So let me talk about IPv4 addresses, right? So I said there's 2 to the 32 addresses, right? It's 32 bits worth of addresses. And they're usually written in 4 parts, like 1.2.3.4 or whatever. And this thing on the right is actually a cartoon, XKCD. You might have heard of it. It's pretty fun. But The tricky thing about XKCD is it actually scooped my research. Because about 2 months, when after we were taking data, but before we had plotted it, XKCD plotted this lovely cartoon drawing a picture of the internet. Now, they didn't probe the whole internet, but they had a great way to visualize it. And so I'm going to tell you about how they visualize it. The way they visualize it, so if you think about a number that goes from 0 to 2 to 32, that's really like one really long line. And it would be really annoying to draw a line that has 4 billion parts to it, because it would be very hard to tell those apart. So rather than drawing a straight line, we draw a curved line, a line that wraps around itself using a fractal. The particular fractal we use is a Hilbert curve. So the neat thing about a Hilbert curve is you can zoom in on it and give more and more detail. So we can easily zoom in and out on the internet. And the other really neat thing is it causes adjacent addresses to appear adjacent to each other on a two-dimensional picture. So what I mean by that is if I draw blocks, and you know, you can look at different size blocks, but the blocks turn into squares on the map. So if you think about the internet, right, the first quarter of addresses are all going to be in the top corner of this, and the next quarter of addresses are in the bottom, and then the next quarter and the next quarter, right? So four quarters. And if I wanted to draw the whole internet with 4 pixels, this is what it would look like. But if I wanted to give you some more detail, I could expand one of those and show the 4 pixels inside of that, and it'll wrap around in a square too. So this is what I mean by it's a fractal. It's a mathematical fractal. And I could expand that again, and I could expand that again. Oops. You could keep expanding this until you get down to individual IP addresses. Okay? So, and the neat thing is, different pieces of the internet all correspond to different size blocks, different size squares. Okay? So any questions about that? So I already showed you the picture, but, so here's the actual data that we have from an internet census. So, this is the same Hilbert curve. In this picture, each pixel is the average response that we get from 65,000 addresses. It's brighter if there's more addresses that respond to us. It's darker if there's fewer. And then it's green. Green is the positive responses, the echo replies. And red, which is a little hard to see, especially with this projector, red is the errors that we get. And so the key thing you can, and by the way, it turns out internet addresses are allocated by ICANN. You may have heard of ICANN. They're actually in the Marina del Rey. They're in Playa del Rey. They used to be in our building, but they moved. But they give out addresses and manage the space. And they give out addresses to organizations that are geographically located. And so parts of the internet are given out to Asia and North America and Europe. Europe is in there. Europe is down here. And then there's an African piece and a Latin American piece as well. They have smaller chunks of it. But anyway, so it's given out in geographically. And so you can sort of see that this part in the middle with Asia is brightly lit up. And this part, Europe, is getting brightly lit up. And then some of the older parts of the internet up here at the top and down here are actually dimmer because very early on in the 80s and 90s when people were given internet addresses, you know, there's 4 billion of them, we'll never run out. And so people were very cavalier about how they used them. Now today, and in this picture you can see, we're actually out of IP addresses. ICANN has given addresses to all of these ISPs, and ICANN doesn't have any more that they can give out. So the ISPs still have one, and you can still get one. But you know, some places are having trouble with this. And in fact, T-Mobile is using IPv6, the new version of the internet that has even more addresses in it, to get around limitations. But the neat thing is, we started observing this data before the addresses were out, and we're still observing it today. We can see how that changes over time, and I'll show you some pictures of that in a bit. But anyway, does this graph make sense? Brightness and, okay. So that's fun. But as I said, each pixel here, you probably can't even see them because the monitor resolution is not, I don't know if it's 60, let's see. I don't know if the monitor resolution works out to 1 pixel per light on the thing.
4 billion amps is sufficient at the
present time? No, 4 billion or not, because we have 6.5 billion people or something. And you'd like to give each person one. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So there is a protocol called IPv6 that increases the number of addresses to 2 to the 128, which is a lot bigger. I think it's like 65,000 addresses per square meter of the Earth's surface or something ridiculous like that. But you know, people have been dragging their feet about deploying IPv6. I don't know if does anybody have IPv6 at home? Yeah, so I do. I set it up, but I had to work kind of hard at it. My wife has it on her T-Mobile cell phone, but people are moving to it. But people are saying, "Well, why should we spend the money on this?" And so people are working hard on that. And I think one thing my research shows is we are running out. We need to think seriously about shifting. But that's a longer conversation. Let me come back to that. Anyway, so each pixel here is 65,000, the average of 65,000 addresses. So what I wanted to show here, each pixel is one address. So this is 4 billion pixels. This is actually a photograph of the wall outside my office, so you can come by and see it if you want. If you print it out at 600 dots per inch, which is about what your laser printer does, it ends up 9 foot tall and 9 foot wide. So. Well, you can print the whole thing out, which is kind of cool. And when you look at it, you see really there's cool patterns in it and stuff, too. Anyway, so we printed the whole thing out. But let me get back to the science here, right? So does this actually mean anything? So you pinged everything, but the first response, and the first response people give me is, look, this is completely useless. Everybody knows everybody blocks pings, right? And in fact, some people say this more colorfully. It was posted to a computer science forum, /dot, and one of the posters said, oh, this is ghetto science. This is just useless. But the bottom line is, we think we can make some strong statements about how accurate our data is. And we know that we're not perfect. We know that they're called so-called NAT computers, right? Your home firewalls have multiple computers behind them. We know that there are computers that refuse to answer us, but we can estimate how many of those there are. And I'll tell you a little bit about how we do that. Okay, so if you think about sources of error, there's a whole bunch of sources of error. Some of them would cause us to overestimate. Some of them cause us to underestimate. So, you know, it's not like we're failing in one direction or the other. We've looked at all of the ones with italics, which is, I think, all of them here. I want to talk about one, which is firewalls, though. And I want to tell you a little bit about how we validate this. So to validate the accuracy of our results, we actually looked at a bunch of different measurements. We used pings, but we also used TCP probing. So TCP is a different kind of network protocol. And we also observed all the traffic going in and out of USC. So that gives us a pretty good picture. If you're seeing everything that leaves USC, should give us a pretty good picture of how many addresses are active at USC. And so we compare to that. And then we also looked at 1 million random IP addresses, because it could be USC is skewed somehow. And so we looked at both of these. And there's a technical paper about this if you're interested. But the bottom line is two things. One is when we look at USC, we know that our results are incomplete. So we get about two-thirds of the number of active IP addresses, right? The rest are blocking our probes or not responding. But we are pretty consistently getting two-thirds. And in fact, even when we look at a random sample of the internet, there we get about three-quarters. So we think pretty much we're seeing about two-thirds to three-quarters of the active addresses. So, question? Yeah, so we don't measure IPv6, so... I have 100% error for IPv6. I know how big IPv6 is. I don't know how much of IPv6 is used. There are estimates of the current traffic of IPv6 is about 6% of the traffic of the internet. So I don't know how that corresponds to a number of active IP addresses. We're very interested in doing IPv6, but that's a different talk. I'm not going to go into that today. Any other questions about the error in our measurements or managing the error, understanding the error? Okay. So let's take a step back and ask how we got here, right? So we started off with this question of how big is the net? And it turned out it took us about 7 years to answer this question. You know, we were working hard and somebody got a PhD out of this. And it took a number of paper submissions, some of which were rejected. And it actually, the work spanned multiple research projects. And a number of different approaches. It's a lot of work to get this right. We had some false starts. We had some things that we had to correct. But the end result is, after some persistence and patience, I think we have the best current understanding of how big the Internet is. So let's ask what kind of impact this has, and I'll tell you a little bit about that next. So any questions on the process of how we do censuses? What type of unit are we counting? So we're counting active IP addresses. So, okay. So there's a whole bunch of ways we can use this information. So beyond just answering how big the network is, we can answer, you know, how well are we using it? Are we using it efficiently? Other people can use this data. And there's actually been a bunch of technical papers that have come out of this. I'm only going to talk about a couple briefly. But the key thing is we laid the foundations for this work, we established its credibility, and then we've used it to do a bunch of different kind of applications. And I should say both us and others have used it. And let me say a little bit about each one of these. So let me start by talking about how big the network is. So this is relatively recent data. This is November 2014. And yeah, I think this might be one census out of date. We do a census about every 3 months, so I think this is our most recent data. So there's 4 billion IP addresses. Of those in this census, 400 million replied to us, the number in the middle here, this number here. Our best estimate is that we're low by 66 to 75%, so we can scale up to account for that. So our best estimate is that there's about 650 to 770 million IP addresses lit up in the world. So about 17 to 19% of the address space. So there's a number for how big it is. The other interesting question is, how is it used? And so this is the picture. It's a little bit dark. But this is the picture when we started measuring in 2006, or early on in our measurements. And what you can see is there's a lot of blue space here. The blue down here and over here is unallocated space. So that's space that ICANN held onto at that time. In 2011, ICANN fully allocated the space, and so there's no more blue, except for the top right corner, which is there's a technical reason so that can't be used easily. And then this is how it is today, our most recent data. Ah, this is slightly less recent data. This is summer of last year. But the key thing that you can see, not only does the blue go away as we move forward in time, but also the green areas, or the areas that are used, are getting to be used a little bit more dense. And so people are getting more efficient now that you can't just go ask for more IP addresses. People are using it more efficiently. And in fact, we see the same thing in California. You may have remembered back when we had one area code, the 213, then it split to the, what was it, 818, and then there was the 310, and then... And, you know, about the time after the 310, people said, this is really, we're getting tired of this. The people petitioned and made the phone companies use telephone numbers more efficiently before they allocated more overlays. And now we have another overlay. We have 323 or something. You know, so eventually we had to give in. But you know, you can use stuff more efficiently. It takes more effort, but one could ask, should we be using IP addresses more efficiently? So that's one of the things that comes out of our work. And in fact, what I want to do is show you, so I have an animation. So our prober is in C. We do a bunch of analysis in other languages, but mostly C. So this is the address space when we started, and I'll just play out the animation and you'll see 10 or 8 years of animations here as it slowly gets filled in. I'm sorry, that's really dim. But you can see, yeah, you can't even see the years. There's actually supposed to be years in there. Anyway, we'll see. There's other animations too. But you can see it slowly gets filled in and that's, oh, and then it wraps around. Anyway. So let me go back. Okay, it's a little easier to see in these three pictures, which are snapshots at the beginning, middle, and end. Okay, but let me go back to that question of are we using it more efficiently? So these are actually graphs. This graph at the top shows how many addresses were allocated, and you can see it maxes out here at the end. And this little line down here are how many are responding to us. So although there's hundreds of millions of addresses that are in use, there's this big gap of stuff that's not actually not being used. That's the big black area of the map. However, if we look at the details, and this line, this point right here is full allocation, 2011. Okay, so one way to use this data is to say, gee, we could be doing better, probably. The other thing, though, is when we zoom in on these little lines at the bottom, you can see the trend is definitely upward. People are being more efficient as we go forward and as people use more addresses. So the world is reacting. And the neat thing is having data like we've generated makes this kind of discussion possible. Okay, so the other thing I want to highlight is it's not just us using this, but there are actually other people building on it. And there's two ways that people have done that. So we actually provide data publicly at no charge through a program called Predict, which is sponsored by DHS. We've given out data to a ton of people, 39 researchers at 33 different institutions, 22 terabytes of data as of middle of last year. So that's our data. But the other thing is people actually use our code as well. And so there's two ways people have used our code. There was a program called Karna Botnet where some hacker was actually inspired by our work. He actually ripped some of our code off of our website and then did his own census of the internet, his or her own census in 2013. And so, and he actually did it, he or she did it by actually hacking home routers and actually did the census off of thousands of home routers. So I don't recommend this. This is not ethical. This is not how we do our research. But if you think about tech transfer, some individual was inspired enough to go off and rebuild half of what we did. So that's sort of success, if you look at it the right way. And then ZMAP is some work done by researchers at University of Michigan who emphasized going really, really fast. And they're able to go really fast. And so that's good for them. That's not our goal. But so other researchers have done other things. So I'm very proud that people build on both our data and our code. Okay, so that was the first journey that I wanted to talk about of seeing something through research and then actually having impact in other people. And you can see it took a while. But it had some impact both on us and others. So I want to take to the second part of the talk now and talk about another piece of research. And this gets us to outages and internet reliability. And to talk about that, I want to talk about something else that came out of our first piece of research. So we were looking at pictures, and so this is a picture of a survey. So in a survey, we probe a fraction of addresses. We probe about 1% of the internet every 11 minutes. And this picture here actually shows 256 addresses. So this is one block. This is 256 adjacent addresses. And spreading out, where's my cursor? Spreading out this way over time, every 11 minutes we draw a column of data. So this is about 2 weeks of data. Okay? And we were looking at this and we said, oh, this is horrible. Look, there's this black line in the middle of our data. Something went wrong. We must have screwed up. And we wanted to fix this kind of bug because it was getting in our way. It was interfering with our analysis. And we looked at that and then we found, oh, it's in other data too. Right? So we had a real problem on our hands. And in fact, in other blocks, there were black lines at other times. So does anybody have a guess what these are? Why would you get a black line in the middle of a network? The green dots mean these computers were responding to us, but then they stopped responding. Nighttime? Ah, yes, you will see that later in the talk. That is not this, though. You can see nighttime in our data. Yeah, exactly. So we think, and in fact I'll show you, this is a network outage. Somebody lost power, or the phone company routing broke, or something like that. Yeah, so we weren't expecting to find network outages, but it was messing up our data. So we went off and tried to fix this. And actually, in fixing this, it turned out to be a much more interesting question to ask, right? Can we not just know how big the network is, can we know how reliable the network is? So the process that we got is we started by realizing, we can ping the network, and if we ping the network over time, that actually tells us something about the reliability of the network. Okay, it tells us that the network is up and then now it's down if it stops responding. And it turns out, we looked at Hurricane Sandy, and we can actually see outages corresponding to Hurricane Sandy in the New York, New Jersey area in our data. And I'll show you that data, and then I'll show how, building off of that, we built a system that's tracking network outages for the whole world. And we have a technical paper about this as well, if you want to get all the details. Okay, so let me show you Hurricane Sandy, though, before we go on. So this one, hopefully, will be a little brighter. And these animations are on the web, so there'll be a URL at the end. You can go look at them. In fact, the census data is on the web. You can go browse it and find your home or whatever. But so this is an animation of Hurricane Sandy. So in this picture, this is 3 days before landfall, and each red circle is a network outage. I'll tell you exactly what we're measuring in a minute. So for now, we're measuring the internet. We're measuring a fraction of the internet, actually. And what you'll see is when Hurricane Sandy makes landfall, you get a bunch of red dots. So those are power outages, primarily in the New York, New Jersey area. And the neat thing is, we don't just know that the network went down, that people were losing network connectivity, but then we can actually see the recovery. So 2 days later, it gets a little better. 3 days later, it gets better still. We can actually see it took about 4 days to fix this problem. And if you remember from Hurricane Sandy, there was a lot of confusion. There were news reports, of course, but you know, people were like, where are their power outages? Well, the power company would post once a day, there was an outage in Long Island. You know, pretty indistinct data. I'm really hopeful that our kind of information can provide a much better real-time or near real-time view of natural disasters. So that's where we hope to go. But this is what we had for Hurricane Sandy. So let me tell you a little bit about how we generated that animation. So the key thing that you can see in that animation is before landfall there was nothing wrong, or almost nothing wrong. When there was landfall, the number of outages went way up, and after landfall it took 4 days to recover. Okay. So the insight in the outage detection work is that sure, we can probe the whole internet, but the real challenge is, again, how do we interpret the results? How do we get good information about outages? And how do we do this politely? Because, by the way, if I want near real-time information about outages, I'm not just running a census every 2 months. I'm going to run this 24/7 every day forever, which we've been doing for the last year and 3 months now. So. Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit about each of these in the context of outage detection. So first, let me tell you, and then I'll go back to Hurricane Sandy and say a little bit more about that. So first, let me tell you a little bit about what you have to do outage detection. So I talked earlier about how, if you remember, I'd have to go way back, but if you remember when I had the little animation and I lost my cursor. You remember all these different kinds of signals you can get back, right? Some are outages, but other things are like closing your laptop. So how do we disambiguate that kind of thing? Well, the first thing we do is we don't measure outages on a computer by computer basis, because if you happen to turn off your home computer, that doesn't mean the internet is down in Westchester, right? We need some way to average out individuals. And so we measure 256 adjacent addresses. We measure blocks. And as long as some of those addresses are up, we say, oh, that block looks up. That block looks reachable. There's not a network problem to that block. And the set of addresses that respond change over time because people do turn their computers off and suspend their laptops or have turn off their circuit breaker in their house. But what we detect is an outage. But this is the challenge, right? Things are, individual addresses are noisy, so we look at aggregate addresses. We look at a block of addresses as a whole. And then the signal that we take to indicate the network is down is if a whole bunch of addresses used to be responding, and all of a sudden they all go dark, or almost all of them, all but one go dark or something. So that's an outage. And the key observation here is, if we use this signal of all the addresses, of multiple addresses suddenly going dark, that disambiguates the kind of noise in our very limited signal. Okay. Question?
Most computers do have a firewall enabled.
Yeah. Yeah, so firewalls, if you have a firewall on all the time and your firewall chooses to drop pings, you will always be down to us. You are dead to us. But that's okay because maybe he's not and maybe she's not. So as long as some people have computers that don't have firewalls, we're okay. And it turns out, even if your laptop has firewalls, and in fact Microsoft Windows has a firewall by default that drops pings right now, it turns out most cable modems and most DSL modems don't have firewalls and will respond to pings. So even if you're dropping pings, the thing between you and the phone company probably is allowing pings. Any other questions? Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. So this assumes addresses are used in, that are, this assumes addresses are allocated sequentially or in blocks. And it assumes that 256 is a reasonable unit to judge. We've looked at both of these questions before. So addresses are allocated in blocks. You can read the technical literature. And in fact, you don't need to read the literature. Look at the pictures, right? The squares in our data show that addresses are used consistently by different ISPs. And we've written technical papers and analyzed data to show that this is the case. That they're not usually divided smaller than 256. Question?
How do I know whether my house has...
You would have to... you'd have to know what your IP address is. Well, so if you turn on your internet and you can't get out, you have an outage. But if you were, say, down at the library and wanted to see if your computer at home had an outage, you would need to look at our data, know what your IP address is, and go see if that block is currently black, is currently not responsive. And we don't actually make, our outage data, our census data, we make available as soon as we generate censuses. Our outage data, I have no Kleenexes with me, that's kind of a shame. Our outage data, we currently process batch mode, and every 3 months we gather it up and process it. So I don't have real-time outage data, although we're working towards getting real-time data. So that's great. That's one of the things we want to do. We would like to allow people to audit their ISPs and make sure they're getting what they're paying for. I will show you data that we have processed. We're interested in making that data publicly available. We haven't done that yet. We're working on it. So come back to me in 3 months, please. Sorry. There's only a few of us, if you remember from the earlier pictures. Anyway, any other questions? Okay. And I should say, please feel free to ask questions at any time. It's always fun to have a discussion. So the first secret sauce in our thing, though, is we're going to look at blocks of addresses as a whole to judge outages. Okay, so that's how we get correctness. The other question is how we get politeness. And if you notice, we're probing every address every time here. That's a lot of probes, and that tends to make people mad because somebody goes and looks in their firewall, and it has these logs, and it says, oh, you keep pinging me, And you know, it doesn't really matter what we're doing, just if we're there, people are going to arrive. And what makes it even worse is some firewalls, so Belkin firewalls, actually take our pings and print out, "You have been sent the ping of death." I kid you not. Now, the ping of death was a real thing in 1997. There was it actually crashed some computers in 1997. It stopped being a thing in about 1998. But the Belkin routers are still very proud to report ping of death. And it kills me. It gives us grief because people say you're pinging us and you're attacking us, which is not true. But anyway, so we want to be really polite. Right? We work really hard to be polite. So if you notice, if our goal is to tell if the network is up, what do we need to know here? Right? Do we really need all of this information? Well, all I need to do is prove that I can reach some computer in your block, right? So I don't actually need to know how many are there. I just need to know that somebody is up. So if you think about it, we don't actually need to probe all these computers if all we care about is outages. What we need to do is just probe until we get one success, because that one success proves that that part of the network is up. So rather than probing blindly, we probe sequentially, and after we get each reply, we ask ourselves, do we need to send more probes? And as soon as we find one's up, we can stop and skip the rest of the probes, and then wait 11 minutes to do it again. So the key idea is we just probe once, and if we get a positive response, we're done. Now, perhaps we probe once and we get a negative response, or we get no response. Right? So in that case, we want to try again because maybe it happens to be that you just powered down your laptop. And so we try again, and if we get a positive response then, we can stop. We now have to do two probes, not one, but two is still way better than 256. So, okay. And then the final case is that after several fail, we give up and declare the network down. And we need to actually know how many should we probe before reaching that conclusion.
Okay. Does Google Analytics provide you with that information if you look at your traffic?
Uh-huh. So will Google Analytics provide me information that your network is out?
No, me information that I have been pinged 27 times yesterday.
So Google Analytics will tell you, if you put it on your web page, will tell you who comes to your web page.
Right.
So I don't go to your web page. I ping your computer. It's a different protocol. It's ICMP, ECHO request, not HTTP.
So you don't get to the page.
So Google Analytics won't tell you anything about me. Now you can, I mean, my pings are public. You can watch them come in. You can turn on your firewall logs or whatever. There's no secret about it. But you can't use, Google Analytics is not the right tool. Okay, so this is the second secret. If you want to probe politely, you can't just blindly probe, you have to probe adaptively. And it turns out, we put math behind this. So the question about how many probes you should try, to answer those kind of questions, we use something called Bayesian inference, which is a mathematical algorithm that treats each response as a bit of information, and you establish belief about the status of the network, and you mathematically sum up your belief as you get each new piece of information. And Bayesian inference lets us use well-established mathematical tools to treat the belief of your network different from your network from your network, because they all might be different. You know, if his network always responds and her network only intermittently responds, we would handle that and tune differently per network. So that's what's going on behind the covers here. Okay, so that's about probing politely. Now, there's three principles behind Trinocular. So Trinocular is our outage detection system tuned to do this kind of measurements. The things are, it's principled, precise, and parsimonious. So principled means we make decisions based on the data that we observe. Precise means I can tell you exactly how accurate we are in terms of timing, plus or minus some error bounds. Parsimonious, sense that we're only sending the minimal amount of traffic we have to do this. And I'll talk about each one of those, I think. Yes. So this is a picture of the Bayesian inference at work. The belief is this red line in this graph, and this network goes down in the middle. And so you can see our belief changing over time. So if we get a couple of losses, each sort of column here is an 11-minute round. And you can see we got a bunch of losses here, and so our belief starts dropping, but then we get a happy response, and so our belief goes back up to 1, and so on and so on. And finally we get a whole bunch of losses, and we declare the block down. So that's roughly what's going on for every single network, for every single block behind our algorithm. And you can see the picture down at the bottom of what's going on, right? You can see the black bar in the middle and the green bars on the other sides. Okay. In terms of precision, this graph shows the precision. So to judge precision, we did controlled experiments. We had 4 networks at our university that we took up and down with a computer all the time for, I don't know, for a couple of weeks. And then we measured it with trinocular. And our probing interval is every 11 minutes. We guarantee to touch every network every 11 minutes. And so what you can see here is for outages that last 11 minutes, we always observe them as an outage. And for outages that are like less than 11 minutes, sometimes we miss them because it's possible the outage happens and then the network comes back in between the probes. And I'm sorry, I can't see it if I'm not knocking on your door. And the same thing with longer outages. So the error is basically plus or minus 11 minutes. Okay, so that's the precision. And then the final question is parsimonious, right? We use the least possible probes that we can do to get by, and in fact we use a few probes in an absolute sense. So this graph is the mean number of probes per hour over every block, averaged over, I forget, this was maybe a week's worth of data or something. And the key thing here is the number we're trying to compare to is this gold bar in this picture. So other researchers measured something they call internet background radiation. So it turns out if you plug a computer into the public network, somebody will send you traffic. Okay? Because there's viruses and there's just random probing and there's errors, all that stuff. So, you know, just like you go outside and you get a little bit of background radiation from the sun and the stars and stuff, if you turn a computer on the network, if you turn a computer on the internet, you will get some traffic. Okay. So our goal, our research goal is to be less than 1% of the amount of background radiation. We want to be just a tiny fraction above the noise. And the key thing in this graph is our mean probing rate is here is at 19 probes per hour, and background radiation is about 20 probes per hour. So we met our goal. We're just a tiny bit of above the noise. And in fact, the amount of background radiation has gone up since we did our work, so we're now even less. But anyway, so the bottom line is we're parsimonious. We're very light on the network. And even though people still complain to me and say, you're attacking my network, we're sending 19 probes to your network an hour, 19 pings an hour. That's about like one, that's the equivalent of, I figured it out once, it's like one Google search for census. Like we ping over a whole day the equivalent of one Google search, so we're not hurting your network. Okay. Anyway, okay. So that's the mechanism. That's the what went on. And again, this took a while. I was trying to get back to the question about science and how long this takes. This took us about 4 years. This took 7 revisions of the paper. And I think 4 rejections from our peer reviewers before we got it accepted. It's been peer reviewed since then. And again, took a bunch of changes in evolution of our approach. It's not easy. You don't always know what you want to do. So let me tell you a little bit about impact. And this brings us back to Hurricane Sandy. And I forget, we go to 8:30 or did you want to take a break for... Okay. I have like another 10 minutes or so. So we're getting there. Sorry, thank you for your patience. I realize there's a lot of slides here. Okay, so outage detection. Let me tell you about the impact. So let me tell you about Hurricane Sandy. So that picture, the graphic that I showed you earlier, this is the data that we had. So Hurricane Sandy happened before we were running trinocular. So Hurricane Sandy actually used the survey data that I alluded to earlier. We were doing surveys where we probe 1% of the internet for 2 weeks at a time. And we grabbed that survey data. We processed it as if we were doing trinocular, but it wasn't trinocular. And because it was a survey, because it was only 1% of the internet, the circles here show the blocks that we were probing. So we were probing a fraction of the blocks in the internet in the United States. So it turned out to be about 4,000 blocks in the United States we were monitoring at the time that had enough information in their responders that we could run trinocular-like algorithms on them. So this is a picture we did. And this picture shows time across the picture. And each row is a network. And then we plot dots when the network goes down. And so what you can see here is Hurricane Sandy happened to make landfall at midnight UTC, which is very convenient for me. Right at the time of Hurricane Sandy's landfall, you see a bunch of purple, and those are outages in the United States. And then you can see them recover over time here. So that's that cluster of pixels shows the outage. And then we can graph what we call the marginal distribution. That's the sum of how many pixels are lit up in each column to show how big the outage problem was. But let me show that differently. This is the marginal distribution over time. And basically the fraction of U.S. networks that were down at Hurricane Sandy. And the first thing you can observe in our data, there's always some blocks that are down, right? Because the U.S. is a big place. Our measurement is imperfect. We're working on it, but there are measurement errors. So that shows up as some background outages. But the neat thing, or the frustrating thing, the sad thing is that when Hurricane Sandy hit, we could measure how many outages happened. And so that's our factor of 3 times greater outages in the United States. And then we can see recovery over time. So you can see the slope and getting back to our baseline represents recovery. Okay, so that's Hurricane Sandy, the graph version. And to prove that it was Hurricane Sandy, we geolocated each block. We figured out where those IP addresses are as best we can. It's an imperfect job, but... And you can see the states on here. So the... excuse me. So the key thing is New York, New Jersey had a big uptick immediately after Hurricane Sandy. So that pretty much... helps give us confidence that what we're seeing here is actually the effect of the hurricane. Okay, and you saw the picture before, so I won't show that again. The other thing I want to observe, though, so that I showed you the picture of Hurricane Sandy. The other thing, we've observed other kinds of natural disasters, too, over time. So the Japanese earthquake, this is the earthquake that preceded Fukushima, had a network outage associated with it. The graph at the top is the Egyptian Revolution. Some of you may remember when Mubarak, thank you. When he was outed, when he was ousted, before he lost power, he shut down the internet to try to keep power. So we could see that red bar is the Egyptian Revolution. We missed the start of him turning off the network, but we got to see it come back on at right there. Turns out there was an outage in Australia at about the same time. Of about the same number of blocks. But, you know, Australia has a lot more computers than Egypt, which is why it didn't make national news. It also didn't have a revolution at the time. And then we also see sort of outages on a day-to-day basis. And these are 3 that we tracked down, and 2 of them we were able to prove in routing information that they were outages that other people could see. Okay, so our goal overall is to understand internet reliability and outages. And we're still working on that. This is a work in progress, but that's what we're working on. So the final animation I want to show you... No, there's 2 more. The second to final animation I want to show you is U.S. outages. And I said we've been taking outage data 24/7 for about more than a year now. So we have outages of an outage that happened in August of last year. Does anybody use Time Warner cable? So did you lose out in network?
I lose out all the time.
Oh, okay, well.
A lot of times it's at night and you don't know it. That's what you're talking about.
Okay.
You get up in the morning, it's down. You say, well, has it been down for a half hour? Has it been down all night? And your data would show that.
So what I'm going to show you, it turned out in August of last year, not just you lost. Where's my cursor? Well, that's exciting. Huh. Okay, this will be fun. So it turns out in August of last year, here it is, Time Warner had a nationwide outage, and 11 million people in the United States lost internet. And it turns out we were running Trinacro at the time, and so I can show you, if my mouse comes back. I think the problem is... Okay, so what I will show you here, let me see if I can do this. So this is a world map showing outages, and what you'll see if you watch the United States is on the morning of the 27th, the circles all get big. So the circles represent outages, and so right about now, oh, there it goes. So that was the Time Warner outage. People lost, everybody in the United States for Time Warner, or 11 million people, lost connectivity for about 2 hours. So you know, we can see that kind of thing in our data. And the neat thing is, we don't just see stuff in the United States. I mean, that was a very dramatic thing. But if you look closely, you can see someplace in Uruguay and someplace in Saudi Arabia. There are other outages around the world that we'd like to calibrate and stuff too. And so we're working on those smaller occasional outages. But Time Warner was a very dramatic event. Okay, so that's the Time Warner outage. So Time Warner published some information, but not very much. Doing maintenance went wrong, and so something happened at their backbone router. So, you know, people are very good about that, but, you know, everybody has errors sometimes. And not just Time Warner, right? Other companies, other large ISPs as well. Okay, the final thing I want to do, and this sort of gets at other countries and stuff that I was just alluding to, we were talking about, can you see things go to sleep? So it turns out we went back and we're analyzing this data as well, and we observed that we can actually see the effects of people going to sleep around the world. And so what I'm going to show you is, we know that network traffic is diurnal. It changes every day, right? And so the graph on the left is network traffic from our local ISP. And you can see there's one hump here because that's one day, and there's seven humps here because it's 7 days. And you can see weekends too. Okay. I'm sorry?
The weekend is there.
Yes, yes. But the question is, can we see computers sleep? Do we see the effects of people turning off their laptops in our data? And can we see that in the Internet IPv4 address view? And so what I'll show you is, yes, we can. So in particular, and what this means is there's actually more Internet part of the day, at least in different countries. So what I'm going to show you is a graph, but let me just show you the picture. So here's our picture. So this is another kind of animation. Now in this animation, let me skip forward. Rather than show circles that are outages, here each square represents the average number of lit up IP addresses in that region. And we normalize them so that the mean for each region is white. And when regions go red or blue, they're either more addresses than average or fewer addresses than average. So what you can see is the United States is mostly white. We're very consistent. And there's a reason for that. The reason is the FCC established a national policy that broadband, we want broadband in this country, and part of the definition of broadband is always on. For your phone company to get credit for providing you broadband, it has to always be on 24/7. But that's not the case everywhere in the world. And so what you can see is in Russia, in India, in China, and in parts of South America, either where they have many more people or many more poorer people, where they don't have as much resources as we do, or in some cases where they have different just telecommunications policies, you can see the number of addresses swings by plus or minus 10 or 20% over the course of a day. So it was kind of fun. We were collecting outage data, but if you analyze that in a different way, you can actually see the internet sleep. So, Okay, so that was what I wanted to say there. And I can show you more about this. So in particular, you can watch, you know, I think this is Warsaw, which is fairly stable, and this is Minsk in Belarus, which is going goes up and down a lot more. So we process that data and get these results. And it turns out sleep is a kind of important factor for a bunch of different reasons. So one thing is looking at this policy, evaluating how the FCC is doing. It turns out, though, if we want to do outage detection, we have to correct for sleeping networks. We don't want that to throw us off. And it factors into other things as well. So just to pull back to the original theme, right, of how the impact of this work, we're actually working with the FCC right now to figure out if our outage detection can fit into their mandate to understand U.S. telecommunications. So that's work in progress. And if you think about the scientific journeys that I talked about, right, for censuses and for outages, I think in the long run, it's taken a long time. It's taken 10 years of my life and a number of my students, many years of their life. But I think we've been fairly successful at advancing technology in certain areas. So if you're interested, we have technical papers. You can download the data. Our website, isiedu/ant, you can go browse our internet census and find your home computer, or look at our animations somewhere where you can look on a better screen. So anyway, that's what I had to say. So any questions? Yeah.
Global events, wars, the Super Bowl, Black Friday, talking about Thursday, whatever that on Friday. I mean, do we have an impact on the speed? I mean, can you measure those things?
Yeah, so that's a great question for speed. So I haven't focused on speed because other researchers have. The FCC has a program that measures broadband speed, for example. I think our data could be used to make some judgments about speed, but I haven't calibrated those measurements yet. But in general, I think there are other people who are measuring speed already, so I haven't delved into that. But I don't know, maybe you can look at it with my data or our measurements. So any other questions? You would probably want to take that into account. Yeah, yeah.
And does ICANN provide information with this particular block of IP addresses is here, this other one is there?
So ICANN provides guidance as to which continent, well, which of the five registries have the addresses. So the short answer is no. ICANN doesn't do that. There are third parties that give us geographic information. One is MaxFind. They have free geolocation information. Other people have commercial services that do better than the free data. But it's a hard problem. How do you know where IP addresses are? So, why would DHS care? So the Department of Homeland Security wants to make the internet a better place. So technically their job is to protect .gov, the U.S. government computer networks. They also interact with commercial providers, .com and stuff. And this particular research grew out of a program, PREDICT, which is a program to improve cybersecurity by providing data to cybersecurity researchers. So, you know, there are other agencies that do other things. I think DHS tries pretty hard to be pretty benign. But I don't know. I'm not going to talk about the TSA agents, but anyway.
Do you have any data from 911?
From 911 calls? Or,
the big
thing. Oh, 9/11. That was way before our work. Yeah, I'm sorry.
There were big things that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, we're working on gathering more data, and I don't know, if something happens today, I'll know a lot more about it. But, yeah, sorry, not that in it. So, So in this chart, in this picture, or I can go back. No, I can't. It's too far. Oh, I just got there. So this chart, we normalize. So this is an average chart. White is the average number of IP addresses in each region. So that doesn't say how many people in Central America have internet. That said, the internet is everywhere there are people, pretty much everywhere, including the South Pole. And there are a lot of people in Central and South America. And although they're not as rich as we are, there are lots of people on the internet. So it's neat to be able to have some information about them. So, any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you.
Oh. Can you tell us something related to the service providers? Who they are, you know, what their philosophy is?
About internet service providers. So, I mean, you know, internet service providers are the companies that you, and in this country, we're lucky that we have more than one. There are some countries, there's some countries in South America where there's a national monopoly, and it's really hard to get anything else. Of course, we typically have about two. So we don't necessarily have the diversity that others do. Do I have it too low again?
Anyway.
Okay, sorry. So internet service providers run the networks. I think one thing I would like my data to do is answer the question of, are there internet service providers that provide better service than others? Or better reliability. There are people who look at speed. There are published results on speed, but no results on reliability. And I hope in a couple of years to have that data. So anyway, that's most of what I can say there. But, okay. So it's an interesting question. How big physically is the internet? I've actually read estimates of that. So. You know, lots of people counted routers and links and got the graph of the internet. I'm the first person recently to try to measure end hosts and count those. How do you go to physical size? I suppose, so first you could basically ignore data centers because even though they're big, there's only a few of them. You know, there might be 100 or 1,000 or something. I think the biggest thing is probably all those laptops and desktops and towers at people's homes. But I don't know. I would have to do a bunch of calculations to try to estimate internet size. There are lots of mobiles. Fortunately, they're small, right? Physically, if we're going for physical size. But yeah, it's a really good question. There's more mobile computers, more mobile phones on the internet than there are computers today. And another interesting thing I'm interested in is how do mobile phones change the kind of pictures I'm drawing? And I've actually done a little bit of looking at, if you look at those graphs, you remember, can we tell which blocks of those are mobile phones and how that looks? But that's work in progress. I don't have the results. So usually mobile phones have a big NAT box in the middle. There's a big computer that relays traffic in and out of the mobile network. I can ping that box. I can't usually ping directly into the phone. But, you know, I don't know, ask me in a couple of years. Maybe I'll be able to do better. So maybe when we get to IPv6. So. Oh, a Hilbert curve? So I showed the picture of that earlier. Let's see. So the picture is the best thing. So the key thing about a Hilbert curve is it's a fractal, and it starts off as a square. There, that's the best version. It starts off, if you have four things, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4. But then you can take each one of those things and turn it into four little things.
Okay.
And you can take each one of those things and turn those into four things.
Like a fractal. Okay.
Yeah, it's exactly a fractal. So that's the Hilbert curve. Yeah, it turns into squares. So. That's a Hilbert curve, and that's what we use to draw these kind of pictures. So, okay, any other questions? Okay, well, you've been very patient. It's a late night, so thank you very much for your time.